sparks, a ratcheting of chains, and the web unraveled. The meteorite rolled out of its cradle, almost leisurely, Glynn atop it. The rock impacted the web of struts and beams, splintering wood and pushing steel aside like butter, descending slowly, but inevitably, in the inexorable pull of gravity. The ship was now canted almost on its side. The hull began to unzip, and the sea came roaring in, white with fury. As Garza watched, the meteorite came in contact with the seawater. At this point, Nishimura had slowed the video. It now progressed frame by single frame. As the water hit the surface of the meteorite, it seemed to froth or boil, and the meteorite's skin appeared to split apart and contract, exposing a glassy interior. It reminded Garza of a chrysalis splitting to release a butterfly. Now the video slowed even more, one frame every second. The boiling of the water around the meteorite intensified, and the red skin of the rock peeled away explosively as the translucent insides appeared to swell. The water rushing into the hold frothed around it. A rippling flash of white light erupted from the interior of the meteorite. Glynn disappeared. And then the video froze. "That," said Nishimura, "is the last frame before the feed went dark. I've enhanced it as much as possible." The image showed the interior of the meteorite, filled with light. And there, suspended in the middle, was the brown, ropey, engorged, melon-shaped thing resembling a brain that they had seen encased in the trunk of the baobab. After lingering on this final image, the monitor went dark and the lights came up. After a moment, Glynn rose and, at last, faced the others. Garza was bathed in sweat, profoundly shaken by what he had seen. Reliving the nightmare had been bad enough, but witnessing the unexpected profession of love on the part of Britain and the callous rejection by Glynn, it was too much. Glynn was standing before them, silently. A strange expression was on his face. For a moment, Garza worried he would collapse again. A single shudder passed through his frame. And then the moment, whatever it was, passed. His look became as cool, as detached, as unreadable, as always. He cleared his throat. "Dr. Nishimura and Dr. Sachs are analyzing that final image, but it appears that on contact with salt water, the object, which as we now know was not a meteorite, underwent an explosive sprouting or hatching event." He glanced around. "We hope these last few seconds of footage will provide some insight into the creature's life cycle and vulnerabilities. In particular, whether that object inside the creature, visible in the final frame, is in fact its brain." Glynn looked around. "Are there any questions?" Total silence. People were too shaken up to ask questions now, although they would surely have some later. Having seen what happened, Garza marveled that Glynn had survived at all. The explosion, evidently tamped by water, had blown him free with just enough force to propel him beyond the sinking ship, but not enough to kill him. Many others hadn't been so lucky, and some, like Britain, had refused to abandon ship. "If anyone has any insights or theories," said Glynn, "please bring them privately to me. Recall that the details of what you have just seen should be kept confidential, for obvious reasons. And now, good morning." And with that, he turned and left the forensic lab without another word. Chapter 29. Rosemarie Wong was used to working in labs full of male jerks, but Prothero really took the cake. He was a jackass, a brilliant jackass. And not just brilliant, but a truly creative scientist, something as rare in science as it was in music or literature. He was someone who habitually thought outside the box, whose mind made startling connections across entire categories, who cleaved mundane reality to find the gem within. and whose acidic skepticism ate away at even the most universally accepted truths. Many of his intellectual leaps were crazy, but once in a while they were not. When she had started working with him 2 years ago, he had just gone through a string of lab assistants, one after the other, nobody lasting more than a few months. Wong had decided that, come hell or high water, she was going to get along with this prize ass because she believed he was a great scientist who, someday, was bound to go somewhere unusual, somewhere important. And when that day came, she would be there with him. In this, she had been spectacularly correct. This secret mission to the South Atlantic was giving Wong a chance to do science beyond her wildest dreams. Just to be part of humanity's first encounter with an alien life form was mind-blowing. If it meant she had to put up with world-class asininity, juvenile crudeness, and preteen temper tantrums on a daily basis, that was the price to pay. As a protective carapace, she had developed a sort of sarcastic, bantering relationship with him that seemed to earn at least a modicum of his respect and kept his nasty temper at bay. She also had come to realize the vulgar nastiness was a form of respect. It was Prothero demonstrating to her that he wasn't going to treat her nicely or gently because he considered her his equal.
Wong, where the fuck is my hat?
Prothero came around the corner of her work bay, holding a screwdriver in one hand and a motherboard in the other.
It's on your head.
Prothero clapped his hand to his head, his bare head, and then grimaced.
Ha ha, where is it?
Probably in the bathroom, where you always leave it. Prothero went out the door and came back a moment later, wearing his hipster hat.
Here's what I've been thinking. We're going to translate that whale signal.
Translate it?
As in decipher whale speak? Exactly.
He pulled up a chair backward and sat down.
And I know just how to do it. I've got the world's biggest collection of blue whale vocalizations here in this lab. We're going to reverse engineer it.
So you think the baobab is trying to talk to us?
That thing's been sitting there on the seafloor for, what, 5 years? Listening. And what does it hear?
Well, 2 miles down there isn't much sound. The only sounds that carry that deep are whale vocalizations. Whale talk is damned loud. It carries 100 miles. You following me?
Yes.
All right. So the baobab is listening, 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 and maybe it starts to figure out what the whales are saying. And now it's trying to communicate with us in the only language it knows.
This was one of those crazy Prothero leaps.
So what's it saying? She asked.
I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today, said Prothero, and laughed hilariously at his own lame joke.
Here's what I think, she said, when Prothero had stopped wheezing.
You know I don't give a shit what you think, but tell me anyway.
It's randomly playing back sounds it recorded. They mean nothing.
Prothero shook his head.
This thing's intelligent. I'll bet anything on that.
And it's sending us a message.
So how exactly are you going to translate it?
You mean, how are you going to translate it? You, Wong, are going to find the closest digital match between that baobab sound and the blue whale vocalizations in my database. And then we're going to find out what the blue whale was doing when it was recorded making that sound, and that'll give us an idea of the meaning. Like, was the whale chasing prey? Was it a mother calling her calf? Was it fucking?
Prothero laughed again.
Wong shook her head. If it's trying to communicate, why not by some other means than whale calls?
No doubt it's highly attuned to sound. Sound is the best way to communicate underwater. Electromagnetic fields dissipate, and light can't penetrate more than 400 or 500 feet. This thing evolved to live in the dark depths of a watery world. It developed a sonar-resistant skin. It used sonar to look at Gideon Crew when he was down there collecting the wreck of Paul. Naturally, it uses sound to communicate, and whale calls are all it has heard.
Digital sound, which means it's a machine. There's no way for a biological system to evolve so as to produce digital sound.
Wong, Wong, Wong,
Prothero shook his head.
Maybe it's a machine. Maybe it's a biological system. Maybe it's a combination of the two. Whatever it is, it's talking to us. Now get your ass to work and find out what it's talking about.
Chapter 30. Dr. Patrick Bramble chewed on a Mars bar as he stared pensively at the crushed ball that had formerly been the DSV Paul sitting on a tarp in the hangar deck. The immediate area had been cordoned off with yellow curtains. Two engineers and as many roustabouts were wheeling in a bizarre device they had jerry-rigged in order to dismantle the submersible so they could extract the remains of Lispinard's body from the wreckage. It looked like nothing so much as a large, villainous jaws of life. Glynn stood silently in the background, taking in everything. The workers began positioning the jaws of the contraption at two sides of the wreckage in order to draw apart the wrinkled, shattered mass of the titanium sphere. Huge eye bolts had been affixed at the two places, and the machine was now set to draw them apart, unfolding the metal the way someone might unfold a balled-up piece of paper. Bramble turned to his medical assistant, Rogelio, who was standing next to a polished, stainless steel gurney. This gurney was where they would reassemble the body. The idea did not overly disturb Bramble. He had seen far worse. But he was worried about his assistant, who looked a bit green around the gills.
"We must recover every, piece, no matter how small," Bramble told the workers.
Glynn's silent presence in the back made him nervous. He felt like a student teacher being monitored by the principal. He had never liked Glynn. The man was cold, remote, a cipher. Never mind the fact he was largely responsible for what had happened to the Rolvog. The assistant nodded weakly. The jaws were affixed to each eye bolt, and a deep hum started up as the machine began to spread them apart. With a creaking, cracking noise, the crumpled ball began to separate along its fracture zones, and water began draining from within it.
"Halt!" Bramble called.
Immediately, the machine stopped. Rogelio rolled the gurney in close and, with large, rubber-tipped tweezers, Bramble and his assistant began picking out mashed pieces of flesh and pulverized bone, mingled with bits of clothing, and laid them all out on the gurney in turn. After a few moments, he turned to the assistant.
"Rogelio, how are you doing?"
"Hanging in there," Rogelio said in a strangled voice.
"Good man."
It took at least 10 minutes to remove every little bit from the fissure in the wrinkled titanium, and then they backed off and signaled the engineers to continue. The procedure went on for hours, prying first one piece of metal apart, then another, and another, in between stopping to pick out the remains, sometimes with the help of a portable magnifier on wheels with built-in illumination. At least it was a cool day, the good weather holding. The temperature inside the hangar was about 60 degrees. Not bad, Bramble mused, for the preservation of handling of human remains. And a large proportion of the remains were of workable size, which was also a good thing. He'd feared the corpse might have been little more than tomato paste. Slowly, the body began to take shape on the gurney, in a grotesquely altered state. Bramble and his assistant had been able to identify virtually all of the pieces by a combination of their position in the wreck, the bone fragments, and the clothing present. By chance, they had started working from the feet upward. Bramble knew that recovering the head and skull would be the last and most difficult part. As he worked, Bramble was mightily impressed by the immense forces that must have been applied to the submersible, especially the titanium sphere, to crush it so violently. In some areas, the pressure had been so intense and so sudden that it appeared to have softened or even melted the metal. It was disagreeable work, and Rogelio bore up relatively well under it, not losing his lunch as Bramble had feared. The two roustabouts operating the machinery and the two engineers were another story, turning their backs, looking away whenever possible, averting their eyes assiduously to avoid seeing the remains, to the point where Bramble had to speak to them sharply to keep their eyes on the job.
Glynn, on the other hand, was just the opposite, watching the entire procedure in silence, face expressionless. He could have been observing a golf match. Nobody spoke, except the fellows operating the jaws, and then only to communicate tersely about the equipment. Now they separated the personnel sphere, laying the pieces out in jigsaw position on a large tarp, spread precisely for that purpose. As they pried apart the last two large pieces, the upper torso, neck, and crushed head became visible. Bramble glanced at Rogelio and was dismayed to see the man had gone pale. The two roustabouts were not even bothering to cover up their horror and disgust. An engineer turned away, retching. Only Glynn seemed unmoved.
All right, let's keep going, said Bramble, moving in with a pair of rubber-tipped forceps, and picking up the jaw, teeth, and skin still adhering.
He laid it all on the gurney. Another piece followed, then another. The face itself had survived almost entirely whole, flattened without being mashed to a pulp. Rogelio worked on the opposite side of the gurney while a great silence collected in the hangar. As they continued, Bramble found himself becoming disturbed by something. It wasn't the gruesomeness. It was an odd feeling that something was not quite right. But he said nothing. He didn't want to seem like a crank, or worse, cause a panic. As they neared the end of the dismantling process, the titanium sphere laid in neatly arranged and numbered pieces on the spread tarp, along with mashed equipment from inside the sphere. Everything had been thoroughly picked over by Bramble and Rogelio, and all the remains were laid out on the gurney. Bramble, bending over them, putting body pieces into place like a puzzle, felt a presence behind him. It was Glynn.
"Have you recovered all the remains?" he murmured.
Bramble did not answer right away. He wondered just how to phrase it. Finally, he said,
"We'll know when we weigh the remains if a substantial portion is missing. Of course, we'll have to factor in the loss of blood and the infusion into the tissues of a certain amount of salt water." He swallowed.
"Of course."
One of the roustabouts, having recovered somewhat, asked,
"Why the hell did the creature crush up the DSV like this? Was it defense?"
"It happened right after Lispinard switched on her acetylene torch," said Glynn. "So I would say yes, it felt pain and reacted."
Bramble said nothing.
"I think it was fear," said the roustabout. "The thing was afraid."
Another silence. Then Glynn turned to Bramble.
"Doctor, you don't agree?"
"Blast, Glynn," he thought.
"If it was a purely defensive action, why would the thing swallow it in the first place?"
"Part of that very defensive reaction."
"But Lispinard was trying to escape, not attack. It sucked her in."
"It wasn't afraid."
"What are you suggesting?" said Glynn.
"You asked for it."
"Think about what the DSV looked like when the thing expelled it," said Bramble. "All crushed up in a bowl like that."
"Meaning?"
Bramble drew in an irritated breath.
"As a child, I used to roam the Killarney National Forest with my brother Simon. May he rest in peace. Two would-be naturalists collecting wee skeletons of mice and shrews, and we knew the best place to get them, near owl nests."
"May I ask where this recollection is going?"
"It's a pellet," Bramble said flatly.
"A what?"
"A pellet, like an owl pellet."
"Good God, man, need I be more plain?"
He waved a hand at the remains, metal and organic both.
"It's a shite."
Chapter 31 The nuclear weapon had been broken down in a most ingenious way, Gideon thought, so as to form six easily assembled pieces. Five of them were on racks, sealed and ready to go. The sixth, the gold-plated plutonium pit, had been housed elsewhere and would have to be loaded last, using special equipment. The room was deep in the bowels of the ship, the close air smelling faintly of diesel fuel. Gideon gazed at the deadly pieces and considered the situation. The main body of the nuke was like two halves of a giant beach ball,
already sporting slow and fast high-explosive lenses. The initiator was in a separate package, smaller than a golf ball, and sealed in heavy lead foil. The detonators were in the fourth package, attached to wires, ready to be inserted into the brass chimney sleeves. The fifth package contained the small computer into which the detonator wires would be plugged and would, ultimately, send out the detonation signal. Garza would soon be delivering, at Glynn's orders, the final package containing the plutonium. Once he'd done that, the assembly sequence was simple, and then the bomb would be ready for arming. The racks had been specially engineered to allow a single person, using computer-controlled mechanical assists and a ceiling winch, to assemble the bomb in about an hour. Testing would take another hour. Gideon was amazed at the elegant, beautifully simple engineering work Garza had done. As long as you knew what you were doing, it was almost as simple as putting together a set of shelves from IKEA. Stuff like this didn't exactly grow on trees. He wondered once again just how much EES had spent in order to procure it. The actual arming of the bomb wouldn't happen until just before it was to be used. It would be armed with a code, nicknamed ARM, to be entered into the computer by keypad. Only Glynn, Gideon, and Garza knew the code. The countdown to detonation could then be started with a simple key press on that same keypad, or by a remote-located computer in mission control. But the nuke, as Glynn had previously explained, had a fail-safe mechanism built into it. This was a second code, abort, that would immediately stop the countdown. Again, only the three of them knew the abort code. Gideon frowned. The more he thought about this arrangement, the less he liked it. His dislike was due in part to Lispinard's horrible death. But it was also a result of the rumors swirling about the ship, that the sonic signals emitted by the creature were a form of communication, that, in its years sitting on the bottom of the sea, it had learned the only language it heard, whale speak, and was now trying to communicate with them. If that were the case, it meant the baobab was intelligent. It wasn't some unthinking life form operating on instinct, like a shark. It knew what it was doing. It was evil, and yet it was, or might be, sentient, even intelligent. He did not like the idea that Garza or Glynn had the opportunity to stop the countdown and abort the bomb at the mere stroke of a key. Glynn did not particularly worry him, even though he was the one who'd refused to use the dead man's switch on the Rolvog. Gideon understood this time around the man's deep animus toward the creature, his obsessive, Ahab-like desire to kill it. But he didn't trust Garza. While he knew they all shared the same goal, the death of Lispinard and the creature's attempted communication had transformed Gideon's view of the life form growing underneath them. He was a different man from the one who had begun this mission, deeply concerned at the idea of setting off a nuclear explosion. He understood now the threat the entire planet faced if this malevolent thing was allowed to reproduce and spread. There could be no hesitation or pusillanimity in killing it. And that was the problem. He had yet to complete the complex computer simulations modeling what would happen when a 100-kiloton nuke was detonated 2 miles deep, either directly under or within triggering distance from the ship. Would the water diminish the effects of the blast, or magnify them? Air was a forgiving and flexible medium that allowed the force of such a blast to expand and disperse. But what would happen in an incomprehensible medium such as water under the pressure of 400 atmospheres, and how would that affect the Batavia? It seemed to him that, at the very least, a gigantic eruption of steam would break the surface. The P-wave, traveling through water perhaps dozens of miles, could easily rupture the hull, and he was pretty sure it would generate a tsunami-type disturbance on the surface that might swamp or overturn the ship. When all the effects became known, and he would soon have to provide them with the results of his simulations, Gideon didn't want Garza chickening out. He wanted to make sure that, once he assembled the bomb, he could arm and detonate it, and that no one could stop it.
No, he wasn't worried about Glynn. The man had nerves of steel. But Garza, he was the cautious one. Even after the device was armed and the countdown started, the man might change his mind about the whole plan, decide it was too dicey, and code in abort before Gideon could stop him. That could not be allowed to happen. Gideon reached out and picked up the computer controller, peeling off its metallicized plastic wrap. He hefted it. It was a stainless steel box about 3 by 3 by 6 inches, with a keypad, plus input and output ports. Inside was a single-function computer, nothing overly complex, nothing that couldn't be reprogrammed. Gideon had to smile. Chapter 32. Despite herself, Wong was mightily impressed by Prothero's library of whale sounds, which he claimed was the largest in the world. At his request, she had devised a small program that scanned that database of audio files, looking for any matches with the sounds emitted by the baobab. She had come up with 2 solid hits and several partials. As she finished the final run, she heard a stomping in the hall outside the lab and knew it was Prothero returning. His ridiculous Doc Martin boots made an unmistakable sound on the steel plating of the ship. "So," he said, removing his hipster hat and flinging it down on a table piled with junk. "What's taking you so long?" "I just finished." Prothero pulled up a chair, swept some printouts onto the floor, and sat down. "What you got?" 2 pretty close matches. "Let's hear them." She played the baobab sound first, as a control, and then the 2 similar sounds from Prothero's whale database, all sped up 10 times to put the pitch into the best range for human listening. Prothero grunted. "Play those hits again. First the whale, then the baobab." She ran through them again in reverse order. "That's close. So, did you look up the circumstances when the 2 whale calls were recorded?" "I did. The first recording was made by a Greenpeace vessel a few years ago, about 500 miles south of Tasmania. It had been shadowing a Japanese whaler. This was the sound the whale made as it was dying, after being hit by 2 Penthrite grenade-armed harpoons by the Japanese. Fucking barbarians. And the other one?" "That was recorded by a Woods Hole oceanographic vessel from a blue whale stranded and dying on a sandbar on Sable Island, off the coast of Nova Scotia. Some kind of virus had interfered with its internal navigation, apparently, and it beached itself. It died not long after." "Both dying sounds." Prothero was silent for a long time, his brow furrowed. Finally he stirred, picked his nose. "What do you think?" "I still think the creature was merely repeating, parrot-like, a whale sound it had heard." Prothero made a face. "Just tell me what you think it means. I mean, to the whales that made the sound. We'll deal with the baobab later." "My first thoughts were that it might have been a cry for help, or maybe a growl of warning or fear, or the equivalent of a whale death scream. Did you find any other matches?" "Only partials. Some match the first part of the baobab sound, some match the second." "Play those." She played a few of them. Notice how all these whale utterances tend to fall into 1 of 2 categories? 2 words. Some sound like 1 word, some like the other." Prothero scratched himself. "So tell me under what circumstances those partials were made, starting with the first. What was going on when it was recorded?" "That sound was made by a pod of 3 blue whales, all together, when one was attacked by a gang of orcas. The blue whales managed to drive off the killer whales through ramming and blows of their tail flukes. They made those sounds as they were doing it." Another grunt from Prothero. Wong reached toward her equipment. "Let me replay the other similar sounds." Prothero waved his hand. "You don't have to. I already know what they mean."
"You do?"
"Yeah," said Prothero. "You hear it all the time in pods of whales as they're traveling together. Lone whales never make the sound. It's 1 of the first words I was able to translate." Wong was surprised.
"You've already translated some blue whale speech?"
"Yeah. Don't tell anyone."
Prothero made a face. I intend to publish someday.
So what does it mean?
That sound is the whale referring to itself. It means me, or I.
Wow.
So what do you think the initial sound means?
It's a verb. That much I'm sure of.
Whales have verbs?
Sure they do. All they do is move. Everything to a whale is movement or activity. I think the entire blue whale language is made up of verb-like sounds.
Okay.
This did not sound very scientific to Wong, but she was in no mood to argue with Prothero.
It's a verb, and it's used by whales that are dying or whales that are trying to drive off attacking orcas. I think it's pretty obvious what it means.
He gave her a superior smirk.
You don't get it?
No.
It means kill.
Kill?
Exactly. Think about it. What's a whale going to say that's dying in agony from a Japanese harpoon? Kill me. What are whales saying as they chase a gang of orcas? Kill, kill. That's what the baobab was saying over and over to us. That's the baobab's message to us. Kill is the first word, and me is the second.
That's crazy, said Wong.
Prothero shrugged. It may be crazy, but that's the message it's sending. It's telling us something, urgently. And that something is...
kill me.
Chapter 33 Barry Frayne was tired. It was 10 o'clock at night, and the exolab had been going almost non-stop since noon, when the long, string-like tentacle had arrived, and Glynn had ordered Dr. Sachs to prepare it for study. Frayne reported directly to Sachs, and his lab contained the frontline workers, the prep guys, the bio grunts. Each guy, and as it happened, they were all guys, was a specialist in a particular area of biological lab preparation. Under Sachs's scrutiny, they had done sections for microscope, TEM, and SEM studies. They had set up biochemical assays. They had done pre-dissections and dissected out unusual inclusions and organelles for analysis. All of this had then gone out to specialized labs elsewhere on the ship. They were, you might say, the heavy lifters, the prep cooks who got everything ready for the PhDs to work on. Frayne, at least, had an MA, but the other three guys just had college degrees. Didn't matter. They were all good at what they did. The gross and fine anatomy of the tentacle, or root, or spaghetti, or worm, a lot of crazy nicknames had been proposed, was stunningly different from any biological organism Frayne had seen before. It was hard to tell whether it was even a plant or animal, or perhaps it was neither. It had cells, or membrane-enclosed packages with interior cytoplasm, that at least looked normal. Beyond that, nothing was recognizable. Inside the cells, there were no normal-looking organelles, no nuclei, endoplasmic reticulum, mitochondria, or Golgi bodies. Nor did the thing have the type of organelles you'd expect to see in plant cells. Chloroplasts, dermata, vacuoles, or rigid cell walls. There were things inside the cells, of course, but they looked like complex inorganic crystals. They glittered like diamonds in the light of the microscope, and seemed to come in different colors, although that appeared to be iridescence or light refraction. Frayne had isolated a bunch and sent them off to be analyzed. He was curious to know what they were. The narrow tentacle had no blood vessels that he could see, nor phloem or xylem channels for the movement of fluid. Instead, it had an incredibly dense and complex tangle of fine microfibrils, like nerves or wires, wrapped in bundles. They were very hard to cut and seemed to be stiffened with something equivalent to plant cellulose, though of a different material, more like inorganic mineral than woody fiber. But what was strangest of all was that, when you really got down to it, there was nothing in the tentacle that actually looked like living tissue. It looked, instead, like an incredibly finely built machine. Sachs had been in and out, supervising the work. He knew she'd seen the same things he had. She must have. But she'd kept her thoughts to herself. Now,
He finished up on the microtome, placed it on a slide, sealed it, labeled it, and slotted it into the holder. It was the last one, and they were almost through. As long as Sax didn't come back with yet another last-minute request.
Hey, Barry, take a look at this.
Frayne looked up and walked over to where one of his co-workers, Wayne Grow, was standing over the main length of tentacle, getting ready to slide it back into cold storage. The thing lay coiled like a thin rope in its shallow tray.
What's up?
Look at that. It's shorter.
Of course it's shorter. We've been cutting off sections.
No, said Wayne Grow. I mean before the last break we took. I could swear it was longer. While they were talking, Reese, another lab assistant, came over and stared down. Frayne turned to him.
What do you think? Is it shorter?
Reese nodded.
Yep.
You think someone swiped a piece?
Frayne asked. He was alarmed. They had locked the lab when they left for their last break, but they hadn't locked up the tentacle. They weren't working in sterile conditions. That would have been an unacceptable impediment to the speed being demanded of them. They were taking their chances that the thing didn't infect them with some exotic disease or pathogen. But that seemed highly unlikely, given how far from human biology the thing clearly was. Still, when they left the lab, they always locked it as a precaution.
I wouldn't be surprised, said Reese.
Make somebody a hell of a souvenir.
Frayne felt a swell of irritation.
Let's take it out and measure it. We'd better be sure.
Still gowned up and wearing latex, the four unlocked the specimen tray and removed the thing. It was hard and stiff, like a piece of cable. They kept it under refrigeration, but it sure didn't look like it would deteriorate or rot if kept at room temperature. It wasn't edible to any Earth-origin microbes, and coming up from 400 atmospheres to one didn't seem to have altered it at all. The thing was, essentially, weird as shit. Working with care, they laid it out on the long, stainless work table, which had built-in measuring marks.
680 centimeters, said Frayne.
He pulled a clipboard down from the wall and scanned it.
It was originally 809.
He started adding up in his head the pieces they had removed. 30 centimeters for sectioning, 40 for dissection, 10 for biochemical assays, 5 for miscellaneous.
We're 44 centimeters short, he said.
He looked around.
Did anyone forget to log a removal?
No one had. And Frayne believed them. They were all careful workers. You didn't get to be on a project like this if your lab work was sloppy.
Looks like someone couldn't be bothered to make a request through ordinary channels, liberated a piece for themselves.
You think they just came in and cut off a piece? Asked Stallweather, the fourth assistant.
What else am I to think?
But the lab was locked during break.
So? A lot of people have keys, especially the ones who think themselves important enough not to have to follow the rules.
Heads nodded all around.
I'll have to put in a report about this to Sax and Glynn, said Frayne. They're not going to be happy about it. And this happened on our watch.
Maybe Glynn did it. Or that asshole Garza.
More nods. This was a likely explanation, and it would deflect blame from them.
Frayne looked around. Time to close up shop. The top brass won't like the fact that somebody liberated a piece of that thing. But you know what? We followed procedure, and you guys put in a good day. Well done.
Speaking of liberation, Reese climbed onto a stool and reached up to the top of a cabinet, slipped his hand deep out of sight. Wayne Grow was smiling knowingly. Reese produced a gallon jug of red wine.
I think we owe it to ourselves to have a little party.
Frayne stared.
What, with that rot gut?
And what if Sax comes back? Stallweather asked. Now that we're at the work site, it's ixnay on the drinking.
Come on. The speakeasy is open for business. Sax isn't coming back, not tonight.
Reese's smile grew broader. He reached up again to the hidden store and brought down a bottle of brandy, another of triple sec, and a bag of oranges and lemons.
Sangria, anyone?
Chapter 34
It was by now after dawn, and Patrick Bramble was mightily relieved to be alone in his medical quarters, without Glynn or his assistant, Rogelio, breathing down his neck. He wanted to be alone, to think, to contemplate, to figure this thing out. He never could think clearly when there were other people around, and he was particularly relieved that he'd gotten rid of the shadowy presence of Glynn, lurking in the background like a specter. That, and the four workers in the adjoining exobiology lab who, hours before, had grown as boisterous as a bloody frat party, and he'd almost had to go tell them to pipe down. In the silence, he got back to work. In front of him, arranged with precision on the gurney, were the remains of Alexandra Lispinard. It was a singularly gruesome sight, much of it looking like coarse ground hamburger mingled with mashed bits of flesh, shot through with shreds of clothing, strands of hair, and fragments of bone. Having arranged and rearranged just about every piece over the course of the last several hours, he had become thoroughly numbed, and now gazed upon the scene not with horror, but with scientific detachment. The problem, he mused, was simple. If the crushed DSV was indeed a pellet, a shite, then the creature had to have absorbed some nourishment from it, the same way an owl ate a rodent whole, digested its flesh, and expelled the bones and fur. Nothing else made sense. The DSV seemed intact, nothing missing or dissolved. And besides, it was hard to imagine the creature eating metal, glass, or plastic. It seemed much more likely it had digested or absorbed some of Lispinard. He wondered exactly what that might be. It could have been her blood. Naturally, the body was completely drained of blood, all 5 liters of it. But he remembered from the video of the recovery of Paul that there had been a faint cloud of blood trailing away from the crushed DSV when it was first discovered. So the creature probably hadn't absorbed the blood. It had washed away. What he needed to do was weigh the body and see how much, if any, was missing. That could help determine what had been absorbed. He called up Lispinard's chart on his computer and noted that her weight had been 58.8 kilograms. With the blood gone, that would lighten the remains by 5 kilograms, for a total weight of 53.8 kg. The amount of wet clothing embedded in the remains, he calculated, was about 1 kg. The gurney came with a built-in scale. He unlocked its weighing latch, activated the keypad, and waited while the digital screen ran through the kilograms. It stopped at 53.3 kg. So the body was missing about 1.5 kilograms of weight. Some of that might be pieces they'd missed, or other liquids, such as lymph or bile, that had dispersed into the ocean. But some, if not most, of that liquid would have been replaced by salt water. Bramble was pretty sure he'd gotten every last piece of her. They'd been fanatical about it, and the pieces had sort of clung together in a stringy way, one leading to the next. What part of the human body weighed 1.5 kilograms? The answer came to him immediately. The brain. Bramble exhaled loudly in chagrin at his stupidity. Here he had carefully assembled the face and skull on the gurney, ears, nose, lips, hair, the works. But he'd forgotten about the brain. Where was it? He bent over the gurney, but there was no trace of it. Could they have overlooked it when extracting the body from Paul? No, impossible. Could the brain, which was also watery, have dissolved and drifted away in the extreme water pressure? The feeling he'd had when they'd taken apart Paul, back on the hangar deck, the feeling that something wasn't quite right, came back again now, full force. He picked up a pair of rubber tweezers and leaned over the assembled cranium, turning over the largest pieces of skull. The inside of the cranium was totally clean, licked clean, one might even say. Even the dura membranes normally found inside the cranium were gone. Gone completely. And those were tough. He pulled the tray of surgical tools close and carefully dissected the first 2 cervical vertebrae, C1 and C2. They had survived the crushing fairly intact. He quickly located the main anatomical points, the dens of axis and the transverse ligament of axis. With the utmost care, he rotated C1 and teased apart the partially crushed mess to expose the vertebral foramen. There, inside, he found the spinal cord enclosed in the thecal sac. The top of it, right where the cord emerged from C1 and connected to the medulla oblongata, looked precisely as if it had been cut with a scalpel. Indeed, it had a seared aspect that suggested heat had been involved.
Bloody hell, Bramble muttered to himself.
He was utterly discomposed. Had the creature eaten the brain? But no, that didn't seem likely, given such a clean-cut removal. Rather, the bastard had, with almost surgical precision, taken the brain. Bramble backed away from the gurney, a feeling in the pit of his stomach that was not good. He took a few deep, shuddering breaths. And then, recovering himself, he did a quick bioassay of the brainstem. Then he pulled off his gloves, hung up his apron, washed his hands, straightened his lab coat, and went off to look for Glynn. Chapter 35. Gideon Crewe stood with Glynn and Manuel Garza at the foredeck rail. They were speaking in low tones. Their conversation was about the nature of the baobab, but as usual, it seemed to wander into wild speculations and crazy theories. It frustrated Gideon that, even now, they had so little hard evidence on the thing. They didn't know even the basics. Was it a machine or a life form, or some bizarre combination of the two? Was it intelligent, or just a dumb plant? This lack of information was becoming a serious problem on board ship, because the resulting vacuum was being filled with rumor and speculation. At least the remarkable weather was still holding, the ocean as calm as a mill pond. Every day brought them closer to summer, and the calving of the iceberg seemed to be accelerating in the advancing spring weather. As Gideon looked out, he counted 6 stately bergs dotting the sea. The rising sun hung low, casting a golden pathway over the water. The calmness of the scene belied the turbulent atmosphere on the ship.
"Excuse me, gentlemen."
Gideon turned to see Dr. Patrick Bramble approaching, looking neat as a pin, but with such a concerned expression on his normally placid face that Gideon grew instantly alarmed.
"Dr. Bramble," said Glynn.
Bramble came up with tentative steps, hands clasped together.
"I've completed the autopsy," he said. "Of Lispinard," he added unnecessarily.
Gideon felt a tightness in his chest. He had viciously suppressed all thoughts of Alex, which otherwise seemed to erupt regularly out of nowhere and stagger his peace of mind. But this he had to hear. He waited.
"Well?" Glynn asked when Bramble didn't go on.
"The brain is missing," said Bramble.
"What do you mean, missing?"
"Absolutely missing. Not a trace of it, not a trace."
The words came tumbling out, his Irish brogue heavier than usual.
"It appears to have been removed at the brainstem, severed as if with a scalpel, and with evidence of the application of searing heat. I did a quick section of bioassay and found that the proteins at the site of the removal had denatured. Proof of heat."
Gideon stared at him.
"Removed? Not crushed?"
Bramble ran a hand across his bald head.
"It appears the brain was removed before the skull was crushed. Otherwise, there would have been traces of it on the inside of the skull, neural matter forced into the fractures. But no, there's no trace of gray or white matter anywhere in the remains, not even microscopic traces. The baobab seems to have... well..."
His face collapsed into confusion.
"Eaten it?" Garza completed the sentence.
Listening, Gideon heard himself tense up.
"That's what I thought at first. But if it was going to be absorbed as nourishment, why remove it intact? And I have no doubt it was removed. What happened to it after that, I don't have a clue. Eaten, absorbed, whatever."
"Scanned?" Gideon heard himself ask. Garza turned sharply.
"What do you mean by that?"
Her brain was removed intact, Gideon said. Why? Maybe the creature wanted to interrogate it, download its contents. That would be a good reason to take the brain out undamaged.
Improbable, said Garza, to say the least.
Think about Alex's final message. Let me touch your face. She was in contact with something. She spoke. Or, at least, her brain did.
If your theory is true, said Garza, how did she speak? She had no mouth. Her body was crushed.
Gideon winced inwardly. Don't remind me. He tried to stay focused, to think through the problem logically. Her brain, removed intact, spoke through the creature. Let me touch your face. Her brain was in contact with something, but her brain was confused, disoriented. I mean, it had just been removed from her body.
Garza's face displayed broad irritation. He shook his head. Good God, if this isn't pure science fiction.
There was a long silence. Glynn, as usual, took everything in while displaying an impassive face. Maybe Garza's right, Gideon thought. Maybe it is science fiction. It sounded pretty ridiculous in retrospect. But he wasn't going to give Garza the satisfaction of admitting it.
And there's another little thing, Bramble said after a moment.
Glynn raised his eyebrows.
It seems someone swiped part of the specimen from Exolab. The four lab assistants kept a log of all sections removed, but there's a large piece missing, and no one seems to know where it went. Did any of you, by chance, take a piece without logging it?
Garza turned an accusatory stare on Gideon.
Not me, said Gideon.
Garza was proving to be a bigger pain in the ass than usual this morning.
None of us would have done anything that irresponsible, said Glynn crisply.
Well, said Bramble, the lab might have made a mistake in its initial measurement of the tentacle, or maybe they forgot to log a removal. He cleared his throat.
Or perhaps the whole thing is a smokescreen to conceal unprofessional behavior. I say this because those four gentlemen had a party last night in the lab. When I passed the lab just now on the way here, I found the remains of a bash. The four of them fluttered and washing the barroom floor, so to speak.
You mean passed out? Garza asked.
That is precisely what I mean. The only one conscious was Frame, if you can call it conscious. And it was he who told me of the missing piece of tentacle.
Where are they now?
Speak of the devil.
And Bramble turned as Frame himself approached. His lab coat was stained with purple, and he stank of wine. He looked like hell. Frayne didn't strike Gideon as the partying type, but there he was, obviously hungover. Glynn stepped aside as Garza turned on the man.
What the hell is this? He demanded.
Frayne began explaining, in a bumbling sort of way, that they'd had a bit of a sangria party, but nothing outrageous. Garza cut him off with a gesture.
What about the missing specimen?
At this, Frayne launched into a complex, rambling explanation, claiming it had happened long before the party, wasn't their fault. They kept impeccable records. Someone had probably stolen it for a souvenir, and anyway, they really hadn't drunk all that much.
You know the rules, said Garza. No drinking once the ship came on station. I'm docking you a week's pay, and because you are the chief assistant, I want you to report to the brig for 12 hours, and to get some sleep.
Brig? The man looked devastated.
You mean jail?
Yes, brig, jail. I'll have a security detail meet you there.
But...
Garza stared hard at him until the man wilted and slunk off. Then he turned to Glynn. This sort of lapse in discipline is like poison on board ship. I hope you agree with me. A faint incline of the head indicated Glynn's agreement. And then, after consulting his watch, he turned to Gideon.
We'd best wrap this up, he said. You and I are needed in Prothero's lab.
Chapter 36 Gideon crowded with several others into the small, messy lab. It was like an electronic cave. An acrid smell of solder and burnt electronics hung in the stuffy air.
Prothero was sitting at a rack of computer and audio components, and cables dangling everywhere, wearing a dirty Hawaiian shirt, half unbuttoned. His concave, white chest, covered with a scattering of wiry black hairs, was hideous. Standing to one side was Prothero's assistant, the tall, thin, elegant woman named Rosemary Wong. She looked exactly like Prothero's antithesis. Gideon wondered how she could stand working with him.
"Sorry there's no place to sit,"
said Prothero, gesturing at two chairs, both stacked high with stuff.
"I keep telling you, I need a bigger lab. This one sucks."
Glynn ignored the comment. "Dr. Prothero, tell us what you found." Prothero began hammering away on a keyboard.
"In a word, we did it. We translated the message from the Baobab. Hey, Wong, play the tape."
She keyed up a tape, and moments later the song of a blue whale came through, followed by the sound that had been generated by the Baobab. Prothero talked at length about the nature of blue whale language. Gideon felt himself getting increasingly vexed.
"So what does it mean?" he finally interrupted.
"I want to warn you, the message is kind of strange." Prothero rolled his eyes dramatically. "The thing said," he hesitated, "kill me, kill me."
"How sure are you of this hypothesis?" asked Glynn.
"I'm pretty damn sure, if you'd let me explain."
And explain Prothero did, again at length, playing the tape one more time, and then playing other recorded blue whale sounds, elucidating in self-congratulatory tones how they'd broken down the sounds, deduced the meanings, verified their findings. Gideon, despite his skepticism, found himself impressed, but not convinced. When Prothero was finished, he asked,
"So why would the creature be begging us to kill it, especially after destroying one of our DSVs?"
Prothero shrugged. "That's for you guys to figure out."
"How do you know it's not just mimicking blue whale sounds it heard?"
"Blue whale speech travels 100 miles or more in water, so this thing's been hearing all sorts of blue whale vocalizations. Why would it repeat just this one? No, my friend, it's communicating with us."
The "my friend" part especially grated on Gideon.
"If this is a communication, it makes no sense."
"Maybe it's confused," said Prothero, shrugging.
"Maybe it's like the guy who goes to France and makes an ass of himself trying to speak the language," he brayed loudly.
"We're dealing with an alien life form," said Glynn. "Possibly an alien intelligence. It doesn't surprise me we wouldn't understand its first attempt to communicate." Gideon shook his head, then glanced at Wong. She was keeping her cards close. "What do you think, Rosemary?" Wong gave a little cough.
"I think Gideon may be right. It may just be playing back sounds, like a parrot."
Gideon felt gratified. His opinion of Wong and her intelligence rose still further.
"Well, if science were a democracy, I'd guess I'd be wrong then," said Prothero, adding, "But it ain't, and I'm right."
And he laughed again, raucously. At that moment, the warrant officer, Mr. Lund, appeared at the door.
"Dr. Glynn?"
"I was not to be disturbed."
"We've got an emergency. The Baobab. It's starting to become active."
Chapter 37 By the time Glynn and Gideon arrived in the control center, it was a hive of activity. Glynn took his position at the central command console, and Gideon stood to his right, at the secondary console. Chief Officer Leonard came up smartly, carrying an iPad.
"Brief me," Glynn said quietly.
"Very well. About 20 minutes ago, the surface sonobuoys began to register some unusual sounds coming from below. They were very similar to the types of P-waves that come from small tremblers on the ocean floor, around 1.5 to 2 on the Richter scale. When we mapped the sources, we found they were clustered around the Baobab, but not coming from it."
"Is it on the ship's net? Bring it up."
Leonard hit some keys on the console keyboard and a seismic map appeared. Glynn frowned, staring at it, Gideon looking on.
seems to form a roughly circular pattern around the creature.
Yes.
Can you tell me how deep the tremblers originate?
Shallow, at least by seismic standards, a few hundred feet below the seafloor. But as we monitored, we noticed the tremblers appear to be going deeper and occurring farther away from the creature, basically in a spreading and deepening ring.
As if the thing was extending its root system?
Perhaps. And that's not all. As you know, we dropped a camera and anchored it to the seafloor, trained on the baobab, monitoring it in green light. We've seen no unusual activity until now. We've just begun to see some movement of the creature itself.
What kind of movement?
A swaying motion in the branches, very slow. And the mouth, or suction hole, has extended itself several times while inspiring and expelling large amounts of seawater. The amplitude of the 2 hertz sound it emits has gone up.
I want a detailed analysis of the tremblers, Glynn said, with 3D mapping in real time.
Very good. There was a sudden commotion to the right, and a technician came running up. A DSV, George, has just gone missing.
Glynn frowned. Missing? Aren't they under lock and key and alarmed?
The thief evaded electronic security.
Who was it?
The technician spoke into his headphones, then listened. They're not sure, but it might have been a lab assistant named Frain.
Frain? Gideon asked. Isn't he in the brig?
The man listened for another moment. He never arrived at the brig. They've had a detail looking for him, but it seems he managed to sneak down to the DSV hangar. They're reviewing security video now. Yeah, it's definitely him.
Was he still drunk?
They don't seem to have information on that. Wait. They're saying he smelled of liquor.
How did Frain get the DSV in the water? Gideon asked. It takes a crew to launch.
He seems to have had help. We're still figuring that one out. Again, they're reviewing the tapes, trying to determine exactly what happened.
Where's he taking the DSV?
Straight down, it seems. Fast. No response on any frequencies.
Prepare John right away, Glynn said.
Then he turned to Gideon.
Get over to the hangar deck. You're going down after him.
Chapter 38. 20 minutes later, Gideon was in the water, watching once again through the forward viewport as the DSV sank into blue darkness. They hadn't gone through the usual safety checklist, but John had been used so recently that they assumed, correctly, Gideon hoped, that one was unnecessary. It was unbelievable. Frain, drunk and joyriding a $10 million mini-sub. If it was indeed joyriding. But what else it might be, Gideon couldn't even hazard a guess. Revenge? Some crazy suicide mission to kill the creature? Gideon was descending at the maximum allowable rate, with the control room monitoring his DSV through the wired connection to the surface. He might have to drop the wire if extensive maneuvering were involved on the sea floor, but for now, he had a good connection to the ship, which, at least, was a comfort. They were seeing everything he was, in real time, as well as monitoring his mini-sub and its life support systems. The viewport had now turned black. A few bubbles flared white as they passed upward through the light of the DSV's headlamps. He had a sonar lock on George. It was about 3,000 feet below him, but he was catching up quickly. Frain, he knew, was a rank novice in DSV handling, and he was no doubt having difficulty maneuvering. At the rate he was descending, he calculated he'd catch up with Frain a few thousand feet above the sea floor. Looking through the viewport, he strained to get a visual on George's lights, but he knew it was fruitless. He wouldn't see them until they were about 500 feet apart. What the hell he was going to do when he caught up with Frain was still being discussed in mission control. If he wasn't able to persuade him to turn around and return to the Batavia, there were various options. But all of them were difficult and dangerous. The technicians above were trying to prioritize and work them out, step by step. There was no manual on this one. The interior of the sub felt particularly claustrophobic.
He hadn't had time to psychologically prepare himself for the descent. Hadn't even had time to change his clothes. He had dressed for the cool morning air of the South, and he was now hot and sweaty, his shirt itching around his collar. He watched as the meters ticked off on the depth gauge. He was 600 meters from the bottom. Any moment, and George should come into sight. And there it was, a blurry blob of light directly below him.
Got a visual fix, he reported.
Keep descending. Glenn's voice crackled through his headset. Try to match his rate and come up beside him.
Copy.
The blob began to resolve itself into a wavering cluster of lights. Gideon increased his descent rate slightly into the red, impatient to catch up before they reached the bottom. God only knew what Frayn was planning to do, and he wanted to stop him well before they came within the purview of the creature. Now, the outlines of George began to materialize.
Hail him, said Glenn.
Gideon turned up the gain on the UQC. George, this is John. Acknowledge.
Nothing.
He repeated the call. Still no response. He was catching up fast, and now he paused to slow his own descent, to position his sub to ensure it was not directly above George, but safely to one side.
Frayn, do you read?
No answer.
Hey, Barry, it's Gideon Crew, can you hear me?
Silence.
Look, Barry, can we please talk? What's going on?
Now, he was only about 30 meters above George. He could see the clear outline of the DSV, see the dull red glow from the viewports, see the mech arm folded up in descent position. He slowed still further as the two mini-subs closed in until he was almost matching its speed. In a moment, he'd be able to look directly into George.
God, maybe Frayn was unconscious, passed out.
He finally drifted level with George and peered through the side viewport. He was surprised to see Frayn not passed out, but looking perfectly normal, working the controls with focus and calm. And the man didn't look in his direction, not even a glance.
Gideon waved.
Hey, Barry, look at me, will you please?
No recognition that the man had heard. Gideon glanced at the depth monitor. They were closing in on the bottom. If he didn't stop soon, the AI would kick in and slow him down. So would the AI of George. Neither submersible would be allowed to slam into the sea floor.
Frayn, can you hear me?
No response. Gideon switched to a private frequency to speak with mission control.
Can he hear me? He asked. He certainly can. And he can hear us, too. We know his UQC is on and at full gain.
It's as if he's a robot.
We can see that.
Can't you transfer control to the surface and just bring his DSV back up, like you did to me?
He's got the override sequence, Glenn told him. We don't know how. Nobody is supposed to have it but me, Garza, and the maintenance technicians.
Jesus, what a balls up,